This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike, and just to tee you up that after the show, I'll say a little bit more about a recent shout-out about making the London FinTech Podcast project more interactive. But first, the best show so far in terms of getting to the principles underlying FinTech payments. Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 46, and I'm delighted to welcome Hiroki Takeuchi, co-founder and CEO of GoCardless, to dive into the fascinating subject of direct debits. Well, that's the first time I've used the word fascinating in a sentence also containing the words direct and debit next to each other. No doubt Hiroki will enlighten us as to why such a prosaic and apparently old-fashioned banking payment is so hot. He will also enlighten those of you in the parts of the world that don't have a direct debit as to what direct debit is. GoCardless was founded in 2011, and they are one of the relatively few London fintechs whose unit of business is the billion, currently processing more than $1 billion per annum for thousands of businesses. Their clients range from gyms and scout groups to the UK government, TripAdvisor, Virgin, Financial Times and Funding Circle. So clearly they've had their tyres kicked and found rock solid by some high profile names. They're backed by some very blue chip VCs, including Balderton Capital, Accel Partners, Passion Capital and Y Combinator. Their Series A in 2013 raised just over $3 million, Series B in 2014, $7 million, and a large Series C is rumoured to be in the works. Their nice, simple strapline is, "Go cardless is the quickest and easiest way to take one-off and recurring payments online." They currently take payments from bank accounts in the UK, Sweden, and the Eurozone. On the last show, Stefan from Exignite took us on a deep dive into APIs. So now you know all about them, and you can understand what it means when I say that Go cardless offer an API that you can use on your website. In other words, they offer themselves as a seamless service you can build into your website and your business simply and easily. There's plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Hiroki. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. Really excited to be on the show today.
Good. And I'm glad that you've recovered your voice because you were going to record last week and lost it, just as I did over Christmas, although your voice came back faster than mine.
Yeah, I feel like half the office has had an illness over the last few weeks, so it's definitely that time of year, isn't it?
Yes, it is that time of year, but also my spine is informed me it's also sort of a time of life in that you've got a very busy business growing very fast and your fiancé has got one growing very fast, and not only that, but you two are deciding to get married in your spare time, so... How do you avoid sleeping at night? And is it the lack of sleep that made you lose your voice?
Yeah, probably had something to do with it. No, it's not to be advised, to be honest.
What, losing your voice or getting married?
Two people running a business together at the same time and then also getting married at the same time. That's the hard bit.
Ah, okay. Well, maybe I'm slightly older than you and I've got slightly more experience having been married myself, but we don't want to turn this into the marriage versus divorce show, although perhaps that's an interesting tangent. So talking about journeys, you were at Oxford. I didn't realise that they did maths at Oxford, actually. Fascinated to find this out. And then somehow you went from being in the car city to Y Combinator, and then went through McKinsey, and now you're just slightly south of Angel, which is north of the city. So you've kind of been all over the place.
I guess so.
Presumably there was some logical thread going on during all that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. I mean, I think that for me, I really discovered entrepreneurship and the idea of building a tech startup at Oxford. So I was part of a student society called Oxford Entrepreneurs, which was all about promoting startups amongst the student community. And there I was really lucky enough to meet a bunch of peers that went on to build really interesting companies and, you know, had that entrepreneurial spark. And when I saw that going on around me, that was where I was bitten by the bug, so to speak, and knew that one day I wanted to be starting a business too.
It's an interesting cultural point because I went to the place where people had escaped from Oxford centuries ago. And in those days, when it came to the old, oh shit, I've got to get a job business, people actually thought of getting a job and nobody actually thought about going and making their own, strange enough. But as you say, now there's much more focus on being entrepreneurial, and I'd seen from LinkedIn that you did quite a lot at university along those lines. Where do you think that comes from in young people's life? He says, as a father of a sort of 17-year-old and an 18-year-old, do kind of young people that absorb the idea that actually you can work for huge, boring corporates or go and do your own sexy kind of stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a confluence of factors, right? So you've got the fact that you have Silicon Valley, which is matured over the last 20, 30 years and is now a big economic powerhouse, which is visible on a global scale. And that kind of provides great role models. So seeing movies like The Social Network that glorify Mark Zuckerberg, or seeing the guys that built Google, Apple, etc. That, you know, they're very high profile companies. So I think that that kind of gives something for everyone to aspire to. But then also I think that what's been really important over the last 10 years has been the formation of communities online where people can share ideas and really get exposed to not only the very high level aspirational elements of starting a business, but also, you know, what it takes and how to think about starting a company. So, you know, for me at least, I was exposed to this at Oxford and was lucky enough to go out and do an internship over in Silicon Valley with a startup that was doing Y Combinator at the time. And being exposed to those kind of platforms, seeing things like Hacker News, where people, you know, thousands, tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands every day are getting in touch with each other and talking about startups, I think there's just a lot more awareness of what's possible. And that's really driving these additional hubs outside of Silicon Valley.
Oh, it's interesting. I mean, the awareness point, I mean, I was actually thinking back. So I did computer science at Cambridge and finished in 83. And at the time, someone who lived on my staircase, he went off to this place called Silicon Valley. Nobody particularly knew much about, other than the weather was much nicer.
Yeah.
And I don't think I ever heard about him again. So in those days, there wasn't such the awareness, and it was just kind of taking off. And
well, we live in a smaller world today, right?
We live in a much smaller world, yeah. Although actually, it's not shrinking that rapidly because aeroplanes still go the same speed. Before we move on to this sort of fascinating world of direct debit and payments, just on the cultural point, much has been written about what it's like starting up in the West Coast versus the East Coast of the States, or in London and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I was interested, going back to your journey, that you mentioned Y Combinator, which has got a huge reputation, but also McKinsey. You know, I found that a lot of people with kind of management consultancy background actually prosper quite well when it comes to starting their own business. I mean, it could be a whole podcast in itself, which is, oh, what did you learn from your time in America and American culture compared to that in Oxford? But just sort of very briefly, what kind of DNA was installed in you over there that you wouldn't have got if you just kind of hung around in Oxford and done this there?
Yeah, sure. So McKinsey, I was actually working in London at McKinsey, so that was very much one of the kind of traditional post-Oxford, post-university experiences of, like, you know, you go and become a banker or a consultant or a lawyer, right? And I think that my time at McKinsey was very valuable. I learned a lot about how to prioritize, how to structure my thinking, how to act as a professional and get things done. And, you know, for me, actually, the thing that I probably took away the most out of the whole time there was that seeing all of these kind of CEOs and high-powered executives in these large companies that I'd always assumed were kind of superhuman to be able to do their job, and seeing that they were actually just normal human beings just doing a really sort of big role, it made it feel more possible, right? It seemed like a less of a jump of the imagination that you could go and run your own business. I think that the time in the States, there you learn about taking on risk, right? The fundamental difference, I think, between the US and almost everywhere else outside of it is that they're, as a culture, much, much more comfortable with failure and taking risks. And, you know, people don't see failure as a bad thing. They see it as an opportunity.
And part of the learning process. We were all little babies once, and we learned to walk by falling over and getting up and falling over and getting up. And
exactly.
Nobody goes, oh, my God, my baby fell over.
No, exactly.
It's a loser in life.
Yeah, exactly.
But actually, as the decades go by, that attitude comes back. So moving on to the fascinating world of UK payments, as a user, like most people, words like BACS and CHAPS and direct debit and faster payment systems float around in my mind, and I don't really know much about the detail of them, although I did happen to see this morning my extensive research in 15 seconds on the tube that in the UK, 75% of UK adults have got one or more direct debit, and the average UK adult has got eight of them, and for people outside the UK or certainly in America where they don't have direct debits, it's just an automated payment from one bank account to another, and there's something like 2 billion direct debits done per annum. But just to set the whole scene, how do all these words like BACS and CHAPS and direct debit and FPS fit together?
Yeah, interesting question. So, I mean, I think that really the way to think about payments is that it's all about how do you get money from one person's bank account to another person's bank account. And what you're talking about is the different plumbing in between those systems. So broadly speaking, there's three different mechanisms for payments in any given country, actually. They are the card networks, which is, you know, the MasterCards and the Visas of this world. And that's where I think a lot of people see the most sort of visible payments is, you know, when you go into a shop and you use your debit card or your credit card, or when you type in those numbers online, that's going through one system. And then there's a second system, which is things like faster payments and actually what used to be called BACS, which is basically push-based bank-to-bank payments.
And push-based meaning I do something and my money goes to you, initiated by me.
Yeah, exactly. So it's where the payer is initiating the payment from their own bank. And then there's this third system, which is direct debit in the UK, ACH in the US, SEPA in Europe, which is a pool-based mechanism, which actually oftentimes runs on the same underlying infrastructure as those push-based bank-to-bank payments, but has schemes around it to enable a merchant to actually pull money from another person's bank account.
Okay, so just keeping it simple, the pull-based ones are where you want some money from me, I've given you authorization to take it.
Yes, and then I can dip into your bank account and pull it out.
When you're approved or when you want?
So, I mean, this is where the schemes become important.
So what's a scheme then? I mean, I've heard the word, but I don't really know what they are.
I guess that's a good question. So if you think about it as there's the infrastructure, which is, you know, the actual plumbing where the funds get transferred through and where all of the settlement happens. And then you have effectively a set of rules that sit on top of those pipes to determine how you behave with those systems.
Protocols, as it were.
Well, I mean, it's protocols, but it's also around consumer protections. It's around how you actually operate those protocols. And the reason that's important is because if you think about it, you know, being able to pull money from someone's bank account, that's quite scary. It's quite dangerous, right? If you don't operate in the right way. So you need to have rules and standards around how those things work. And that's really what direct debit is it's a set of rules on top of these bank-to-bank payment pipes that govern how people pull money out of people's bank accounts.
Okay, and so, for example, in a scheme, there will be the kind of thing, again, as a user, I'm only dimly aware, but the kind of thing, which is that, let's say I've set up a direct debit mandate with Go Cardless for some reason, come and drink your coffee every week, and then, you know, one day you've taken $1 million out of my account. It'd be nice if there wasn't $1 million in the first place, but let's gloss over that. And then I complain to my bank and say, oh, that's not fair. You know, they're only supposed to take £5 a week, not $1 billion. And the bank somehow beats you up and gets the money back.
Exactly. So that's what those rules are there for, is to kind of protect consumers in that sense.
Okay, so then there's stories that I'm going to go into in a podcast in April or May with Rich Wagner, who's now the chairman of the Emerging Payments Association. He was on in LFP 031 talking about his company APS, which is that payments people are lobbying for access into a low level of this architecture. And also there's the payments regulator who's been saying that Vocalink should be opened up, which is one of the things which is below all these things we're talking about and is owned by the banks. And there's a whole, again, a whole podcast into that, which we'll be doing in a month or two's time. Putting the kind of architectural stuff and where you're allowed to plug in to one side, you have built a payments fintech. Other people are building payments fintechs. How do you operate? How do you plug into this kind of stuff? Because using this sort of simplified journalistic perspective, oh, there's a sort of legacy systems there and you sit on top of this pile of crap. And how do you avoid just being the sort of lipstick on a pig, as it were? Or maybe you are the lipstick on a pig, but at least you look prettier.
Yes. So, I mean, it's a good question, right? So I think that it kind of goes to the point around where is the innovation happening in payments? And at the end of the day, that the innovation that's happened over the last sort of 10 years or so in terms of payments has actually been at a fairly surface level, right? It's taking those existing infrastructures and those existing pipes and making them easier to access, easier to use. And that's very important because from an actual user perspective and from a business perspective, that's where a lot of the value is, right? But fundamentally, the way in which payments and money is moving between these systems isn't changing a great deal. And so if you were to actually ask me what do I think is the biggest fundamental innovation in payments over the last 10, 15 years in the UK, it would actually be faster payments. It wouldn't be what any of the startups that have been working on have done. It'd be faster payments because that was a fundamentally new piece of infrastructure. And so what we do and the way in which we operate is always got to be determined somewhat by the availability of that infrastructure. And that is why a lot of fintech companies, the regulators, are really trying to push for wider and more open access to these pipes.
So briefly, for people outside the UK, someone who's got a UK bank account like me can probably go in there, and the direct debits are set up basically for free, as far as you can see. The faster payments are for free and immediate. The BACS takes 3 days. Why people would use that given faster payments, I don't particularly know.
BACS basically doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, exactly. There's no point in that. And then CHAPS in the UK, which was the same-day payment and still is the same-day payment, particularly used for large property transactions or something, if you buy a house, that costs you 25 quid. So from those various payment mechanisms, if I want to go off and I get so excited by payments, I think, oh, I'm going to start my own payments fintech tomorrow. Which of these can I plug into at the moment?
So this is the thing, right, is that what you're talking about there is, as a bank account holder and as a individual, how can I push money out of my account? There's relatively open access to that as an individual, right? You can go into your online banking, you can go into your bank branch, and you can make a payment. But that doesn't really help you to build a payments company, because fundamentally, to be a payments company, you need to be able to get person A to pay person B when you're neither person A or person B, right? And that's a very different challenge.
So when you're person C, in fact.
Exactly. And so you need to be able to get a level of access to the systems where you can initiate these transactions. And for us, the way we do that is via direct debit and working with the banks in order to get sponsorship into the system. So, for example, in the UK, we work with RBS and we work with Barclays to actually get access to these systems and make all these transactions work. But fundamentally, we have to work based on the existing access rules and the existing entry points as anyone else. And that's why, you know, I think that there is a lot of talk about how can you open up more at the infrastructure level, because typically speaking, you're always going to have to access these systems via the banks.
Okay, so, I mean, the metaphor I used before is a bit unfair about lipstick on a pig. I mean, from one perspective, it's kind of correct, but from another perspective, it's misleading, because clearly you guys do a very good job of making this pull payments technology, the direct debit one, easier, simpler to use, and more enticing. Otherwise, you wouldn't be doing $1 billion per annum and all these people wouldn't sign up with you. So, you know, just to give me some kind of fag packet, let's say, for example, I decide to make the London FinTech podcast, you have to pay for it. And you have to set up some account with me, and I take $1 a podcast out of people. Yep. If I just go to my bank, a typical bank, kind of how long does that take me, or whatever the relevant parameter is, compared to if I just go to you guys? How much easier is it to do it?
That's a really good question, right? So from the perspective of GoCardless and what we're doing to make it easier to take these payments, that's one of the biggest changes we brought to the market, was that up until GoCardless, to get access to these systems, you had to be of a certain size. So if you actually had a couple of thousand customers and you were taking a few bucks a month from them, then you wouldn't have qualified to get access to direct debit.
Oh, interesting.
No one would have given you access. So, it would have been impossible.
Okay, so the first thing is that actually I can't do it.
Calling
up the bank.
Yes.
So that's a huge change. That's not lipstick on a pig. That's allowing people to enter that couldn't enter before.
Yeah, so I think that, like, maybe the lipstick on a pig analogy is a bit harsh. But I think maybe an easier way or a better way to think about it is, what we do is we're kind of like a duck, right? In the sense that, you know, a duck's there calmly floating along the pond, but underneath it's going crazy, right?
That's a good quote, actually. Hey, Rocky, CEO of GoCardless, says, beneath the surface, we're going crazy.
Yeah, believe me, it's not
I'll tweet that one.
What we're really doing is taking those old legacy infrastructures and systems and automating as much of it as possible, and taking care of the bits that we can't automate with a level of expertise that we can develop because we're very focused on one thing. And then by doing that, we can offer a much simpler system that's more accessible to anyone that wants to take these kind of payments.
Okay, so the first thing is that you're increasing access. So if I want to charge a couple of bucks for the podcast, the bank aren't going to be interested in me, but I can come through you. The second is that clearly you make the process simpler and smoother.
Yeah, there is a third one, but that's kind of our longer term ambition, which is around building on top of these different systems, because right now we're talking about the UK, but actually, you know, businesses in France or businesses in Germany or businesses in Sweden, they all want to be collecting payments this way as well. And the problem with these kind of bank-to-bank payment systems, which we haven't really touched on yet, is that each country has its own banking system. And each country, whilst they'll have something that looks like direct debit, it'll be called something else, it'll work in a slightly different way. They're separate systems. Yes. And so what we're doing is building on top of these various different direct debit systems to create one coherent interface.
Okay, so that's a good point to move off the island and consider the rest of the world, because at the moment the podcast has about 40% of its downloaders in the UK, which means the 60% out of the UK. And if I'm living in my dream world where everyone's paying me $1,000 per episode, which avoids me having to get any day job, then I'm going to have to collect payments from other countries. And after donkey's years, I've just about noticed the difference between BACS and CHAPS and FPS and direct debit. But then I go around Europe, and this so-called single market that people spoke about decades ago isn't quite a single market, because they've got a whole bunch of acronyms in each bloody country. And
It's getting better.
It's getting better, is it? Okay. So tell us then, sort of briefly, let's just take Europe for a start. Is Europe got relatively similar things in the countries?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess, like, actually, if you kind of look at it at a slightly more macro level, basically, at the start, I said there's effectively three payment mechanisms, or, you know, three sets of pipes in any given country. And some countries might have other sets of pipes which are more specific, but, you know, those three will typically always exist. And so, you know, you have your card systems, you have your push-based payment mechanisms, and then you have your pull-based payment mechanisms. And those last two are bank-to-bank. Now, the card systems are somewhat homogenous across the world. So if you were collecting your $1,000 an episode, it's kind of going up in price every time we talk about it.
Absolutely, I'm dreaming.
Your listeners are going to be very worried by the end of the episode.
They'll all be phoning the bank saying, we didn't get $1,000 of value, we want the money back.
Exactly. But say you were charging them that $1,000 a month and they were all based in different countries, actually the only real pragmatic way you could do that right now is to do it via card payments. And that's because whether you have a German credit card, although not many people in Germany have credit cards, but say you had a German credit card or a Japanese credit card or a UK credit card, you can charge it in the same way. That doesn't exist with bank-to-bank payments.
Okay, and without complicating things, I'm sure every listener will be aware of PayPal.
Yeah.
So where would something like PayPal come into? Because again, if I hadn't spoken to you guys, I'd think, oh, well, you're going to use PayPal, and I'd moan about the fees and that kind of stuff. Where do they plug in then?
Well, this is the point, right? So what PayPal does is they build on top of various payment systems, but they act like a credit card processor. So you're going to be getting charged the same kind of fees that you would if you were taking a payment via a credit card. And actually, one of the big problems, and one of the reasons why we focus quite a lot on recurring payments, is that when it comes to recurring payments, credit cards are actually a very poor way of taking payment, because you have very high failure rates. If you think about just the fact that the average lifespan of a credit card is about 18 months, that means that every month, one in 18 of your customers, just by virtue of their credit card expiring, is going to fail, right? That's a big, big problem for a subscription company. And so by creating a more bank-to-bank payment mechanism which works around the world, we can offer a much better solution for these kind of subscription payments.
I think Dave Birch, when he was on the show talking about payments, said that when he started in payments, I don't know, 30, if Dave's listening, it's probably 40 years, isn't it, Dave? But anyway, he said 30 or 40 years ago, people had the same complaints they have now, or same desires. They wanted it faster, better, or cheaper. Mm. And 30 or 40 years later, people want it faster, better, or cheaper. So taking the PayPal as an example, they provided better in that, you know, any web company or web shop back in the day when the web started could just use it, and then they wouldn't have to worry about difference between Germany and France, and they would even know about it. But they didn't necessarily do it faster, and they didn't do it cheaper.
Exactly.
So in terms of maybe moving on to Go Cardless and your vision of the future, as I say, at the moment you're doing this direct debit thing clearly extremely well, because people want to use you. In terms of you wanting to do it faster, better, cheaper, and over more countries, what's your kind of vision?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess our vision is that basically we believe that the payment systems that currently exist don't really suit the web, right? If you were going to design a payment mechanism for the internet, it wouldn't really look like the credit and debit card systems with lots of complexity. They were designed in a world where you were trying to connect up shops and restaurants before the internet existed to the banking systems, right? And when you draw out like the ideal payment network for the internet would look like, you know, you have things like Bitcoin that people talk a lot about, but fundamentally, as long as the primary store of people's value is their bank account, i.e. where do I get my salary paid into, where does the majority of my money sit, so long as that's a bank account, the challenge is really how do you make the most efficient bank-to-bank payment network.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more with you. I mean, I'm still get very frustrated after sort of several years at this when you do hear some fintechs talk about, oh, we're going to destroy banks. They're totally glossing over the fact that our entire conception of what we think of as money is actually bits in bank computers.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say that that makes the bank safe because, you know, there's actually more and more fintech companies coming about that are actually building banks. So my co-founder, Tom, you know, he's starting Mondo. Yeah,
in 96 seconds on CrowdCube.
Those guys are doing great.
So there are lots of banks coming along.
But I think the concept of a bank is still going to exist.
They're still banks. Yeah? Exactly. Until somebody says, we're going to stop using this thing we think of as money, but which is actually just bits in a bank computer, and we're going to go back to using pieces of shiny glass or Bitcoin 7.0 or something, then you can replace the banks. Until then, all a fintech can do is, as you say, slice off some of the banking business, but it has to. Every bloody fintech needs a bank account for its own money, and that tells you a lot, you know? So your vision is connecting, helping people connect different bank accounts cheaper, better, faster, shall we say?
Exactly. So what we want to do is we want to create a payment network on top of the banking systems to make it much easier to create a bank-to-bank transaction. Now, when you think about that, the reason why we're working on direct debit is because it's the closest mechanism that exists at the moment, which has access to all of the different banks and enables you to pull money out of someone's account.
And going back to Europe, that works across Europe, does it?
Well, in Europe, you have now something called SEPA, which sits across the different Eurozone countries, which enables you to effectively do a direct debit transaction from any bank in the Eurozone. But that doesn't cover the UK, it doesn't cover Sweden, the US has a separate system, Australia has a different system, Japan has a separate system. And so, you know, what we're really doing is connecting up all of those different systems into one coherent mechanism. And that's what we're working on at the moment.
And at the moment, which ones are you connecting up?
So at the moment, we connect up the UK, we connect up the entire Eurozone via SEPA, and then we connect up Sweden. And then we're working on more markets. So we're working on Canada, Australia, the US, Japan, Brazil. These are all kind of other markets that are on our roadmap.
And I think for those people who haven't got their fingers dirty in finance, that's easier said than done because there's so much detail. I mean, devil lies in the detail and there's so much nitty-gritty. That's not the work of a Friday afternoon adding a new country.
I wish it was.
Just give me an idea. Let's say you add in, let's say Canada, without revealing any commercial secrets. You walk out to the troops and say, guys, let's do Canada. Is that an afternoon, a day, a week, a month, a year?
We're talking like a year.
Wow.
I mean, you know, in order to actually make this happen, you have to go and build relationships with the banks out in those countries. You need to go and get the right regulatory approvals. You need to actually understand how these systems work and how they differ from the systems you already build on top of. And then you need to get the right abstractions in terms of the systems that we have so that we can plug in these various different looking pipes into one coherent mechanism.
That's a great query. I thought it'd take a while, but it gives you an idea why actually there's certainly not so many good fintech payments, because it's in principle very simple. Everyone can understand moving money from one bank account to another, and banks are banks, they're all over the world. How hard can it be, as they'd say on Top Gear? Yeah. The answer is pretty hard.
Well, yeah, especially when they all have their own different way of doing it, right? So, yeah, definitely. But that's where the value is as well. That's the opportunity that we're going after.
Absolutely. If it was easy, everyone would be doing it. Okay, so trying to pull all of this together, I hope by now that listeners have got an understanding of push and pull and cards, and the fact that actually, if you've got a portal like GoCardless, that it really simplifies using this complex global system. I mean, you know, the world is global, quotes, unquotes, but actually it isn't yet one place. So coming on to GoCardless, I mean, there are, with a bit of luck, over 2,000 people listening to this episode, Hiroki. I'm sure many of those, as individuals or actually as their companies, could use GoCardless, and without going into some sales pitch, but actually just being helpful to them, what kind of folks or businesses should actually check you guys out, and where are you relevant or where you're not relevant?
Where I think that we're really strong and where we focus our customer base is on recurring payments. So it's all about subscriptions. And so, you know, if you're collecting subscriptions for a podcast, you know, if you start charging,
yeah, 100,000
now. 100,000, I guess. Or you're, you know, running a magazine or even a local sports club, you know, taking payments time and time again from the same people. That's where we have the strongest offering. And so we work with everything from Boy Scout groups through to companies like The Guardian or The Financial Times or Thomas Cook. One of my favorites recently, Thomas Cook have just launched the ability for you to pay for your holiday on installment. And, you know, that wasn't possible before because using these direct debit systems was just too much of a pain. And, you know, we're helping them to make that happen. So hopefully more people are able to go on their dream holiday as a result. So, you know, that's the kind of use case that we focus on.
And you also are used by various fintechs.
We work with companies like Funding Circle, Nutmeg, where you're paying in funds on a regular basis, or, you know, in Funding Circle's case, paying back the loans on a regular basis. We help them with those kind of payments.
And I think that in itself is also a very strong recommendation. I mean, in any particular industry, if you get the industry using you, that's an immense vote of success, because as I know, hanging out with folks, there's quite a lot of bitching that goes on in fintech. Oh, about, you know, X, Y, Z, have you heard this, that, and the other? But when people say, oh yes, we actually use Go Cardless, I mean, it takes me a while getting around London, but I think the first was over a year ago, someone mentioned Go Cardless. Oh yeah, we use Go Cardless, and they're very good. You know, so when it's kind of within Tribe getting praise, that's really very impressive indeed. So are there any angles here that we haven't covered, Iroki, that we should have touched on, do you think?
No, I think that was a good conversation.
Oh, excellent. And your Series C $1 billion will enable you to conquer the world.
Yeah, we'll announce something soon enough.
Yeah, exactly. Your billion raise will go along with me charging $100,000 for the podcast. I think it gives people an understanding from the outside, I mean, in terms of A's, B's, C's, D's, E's, F's and G's. One thing I occasionally think from the outside is why they're doing so many rounds. And, you know, a simple answer to that is that actually there's quite a lot of countries in the world, and as you've explained, they're all very different. And there's a lot of work to do to add each region, each area, and all this kind of stuff, and it nibbles up the money. So you've been extremely successful in the past. You are extremely successful at the moment, and I wish you every success in the future. And thanks very much for making all that clear. I think I certainly understand more than I did when I started, and hopefully the audience do too.
Thanks for having me.
So, on the podcast housekeeping front, as I mentioned on the last show, folks have been sending me kind feedback and asking how they can support the cause. I mentioned checking out londonfintechpodcast.com/support. You can spread the word, leave a review on iTunes, and now donate towards the podcast. Many thanks for the new reviews on iTunes, and a special shout out to Charlie Barker, CTO extraordinaire, for being the first to donate towards the podcast and pay for this month's hosting fees. On the second initiative, for some time, folks have been asking for London Fintech Podcast Live. Suggestions fell into three categories. The first was social, second, a live podcast event, and the third, a webinar-based approach, given the global audience. Let's start with the first suggestion. If folks fancy socialising, I'm going to Eddie George's New Finance London March Fintech Meetup on Wednesday, March the 23rd. Eddie's help in promoting the show has been invaluable, and both he and I would be glad to meet you there.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so grey, with the pain of the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, watch the firelight dance with me. Watch Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance with me.